Book session number 13281, reel 3.
Is it Scroggy, reel 3?
Yes, Germans in the farmhouse is what he said. So I gathered the boys together, platoon strength, and certainly we followed the correct procedures and took advantage of ground and all the rest of it and stole up in this farmhouse. I tell this one because it is, must be very typical of innumerable skirmishes that took place in that kind of terrain in the Italian theatre of operations. Well, I, idiotically enough, was out ahead with the leading section, and we crawled up this sunken road and got very close to the farmhouse, and I said to Fraser MacDonald, one of my corporals, "Fraser, ease that gate off its hinges and crawl through and man that bank there and bring your weapons to bear on the farmhouse." Well, as I was doing this, I became aware of a pattern, a dancing pattern on the cobblestones beside my right foot. I didn't hear anything. It was after a while I realised it was a stream of Spandau bullets. The Germans had spotted us and they'd opened up on us. And really, what a splendidly sporting little thing ensued. I sent a section around one side to set up the Bren gun and blaze away at the Jerrys from that side. I followed a flooded ditch with the rest of the boys to get round the back of the place. Meantime, a thunderstorm had come on, a deluge of rain, and the Jerrys had put up the red over, green over red for the mortar fire to come down, and the mortar bombs were banging away, fortunately not amongst us. And we got round the back, and the Jerrys were firing out the windows with their semi-automatic weapons, and we were hurling grenades in. And I remember Wilson got a few fragments on his face, this French chap, and bleeding, nothing serious. And we went round the corner, the two of us, passing an abandoned Spandau machine gun in a doorway. And as we went round the corner, I was looking over Wilson's shoulder, and out of a bush rose the ugliest little character I have ever seen, a little wizened German corporal. And he had the big red K on his tunic, which showed he'd been in the Crimea and murdered thousands of Russians. And he was raising a Mauser rifle to shoot when Wilson let go an entire magazine of the German Schmeisser that he carried, and the guy simply disappeared. I flung a smoke grenade, and we went across there, and by Jove, the rifle had been knocked out of his hand, and he was stone dead, shot through the heart. It was either him or it was us. The funny thing about that kind of thing is, if that kind of thing had happened in the high street in Dundee, it would have been murder, it would have been awful. But in the context of war, you know, it's totally different emotional and ethical and moral continuum. That kind of thing's perfectly okay. Either he kills you or you kill him. And these are the rules, and they're understood by both sides. So I took his papers and identifying things and so forth, and we went round the other side. But this time the Germans had managed to make their escape past the blokes I'd set there to catch them when they came out. The boys said some Italian peasants went past, but they were probably the Jerrys with their tunics off and just shirts and trousers. And Fraser MacDonald, whom I'd left manning the bank and shooting at the house from that side, was sitting with his arm in a sling and his face as yellow as a mepicrine tablet and a neat round hole in his cheekbone. I said, "How do you feel, Fraser?" He said, "Not very sociable, sir." However, we got him back and we got him to hospital, and by Jove, that he'd crawled up the bank and found himself looking straight into the muzzle of a Schmeisser being fired by one of the Jerrys. And one of the bullets at point blank range had struck him in the face and he'd rolled down the bank. He got to hospital and they took out that bullet from under his left shoulder blade. It had gone in his cheek, gone down through his throat, past his lungs without touching anything that mattered at all. And they took out the bullets, and he was back in a month of 5 weeks. And what a splendid bloke Fraser was. He was a Speyside farmer in Civvy Street, just died a year or two ago. Fraser was one of these guys, and there were plenty of them in the army, who had far more ability to be a junior officer or even a senior officer than many blokes who were these things. No, no, he just wanted to remain one of the boys. And maybe it was useful to have someone of Fraser's personality and intelligence down, as it were, amongst the boys. He and I, a dreadful incident happened, dreadful incident, just after the Lovett scouts got into the line, facing Jerry in his Gothic line, wherever that was. Nobody knew at the time, not in our sector anyway. We got three jobs to do that night. One section had to guard something that was going on a ridge to our left. Another section had to guard signalers who were rolling Don 5 cable, telephone cable, out to a forward section of the scouts in a little village further forward. And the other was to remain and man the top of what the boys had already called Scroggy Hill, a little place where we had our slit trenches and had dug in that day. Well, I was decided to go with the line rolling party. Night of the full moon, perfectly still air, gloriously warm, and we rolled out the wire. And when we came back, we found three guys lying on the ground, groaning. Another one bending over one of the three guys lying on the ground, and my sergeant, Sergeant Frater, I can only say gibbering somewhere in the background. I said, "What's the story?" I said, we were just going up to man Scroggy Hill when we were ambushed by Jerry Patrol, and Jimmy McLean is shot in the stomach, and Bomber Brown is dead, and Tracy is seriously wounded. Well, you know what it was actually when I got the thing sorted out. Sergeant Frater, I didn't know this at the time, was subject to brainstorms, which came on him at the time of the full moon. And he was leading his section up onto the top of Scroggy Hill, and he suddenly turned round, he had a brainstorm, and just opened up on them with his Tommy gun. Whereupon all the boys, not knowing what had happened, hurled themselves on the ground and began shooting in every direction. And those two guys who were lying still alive, they died later, they'd got Tommy gun bullets in them, .45, not German ones. And Bomber Brown, Fraser and I buried him in situ with a little cross made of wood, and his identity just hanging there, waiting for the Imperial War Graves Commission, who would pick him up, you know, in a week or two, a month or two. And Fraser picked up a bent bullet from the ground with blood and a bit of flesh on it, and it was a .303 bullet from one of the boys' rifles. They were all killed by their own troops, all due to the insanity of Frater. It was a very nasty business indeed.
When you say insanity or brainstorm, you mean he just went berserk?
Yes.
Because of strain or something?
No, I think he had a history of intermittent insanity. I don't think he should ever have been in a war zone at all for that reason. And he suffered from genuine lunacy. I've known, and my headmaster at school suffered from lunacy as well. He had brainstorms at the full moon, eh? And Frater tended, had shown funny symptoms previously on nights of the full moon, but this night he really went crazy and just opened up on the boys, supposing that they were Germans. Well,
you mean literally the full moon?
Literally the full moon, yes. Literally the full moon.
What was your attitude towards the enemy in the Apennines? You've already suggested
not at all. At the battle school, they tried to make us hate their foe. It was just ridiculous, because the British Army are incapable of hating the foe. The Poles hated the foe. They had very good reason, because they'd been butchered and raped and reduced to rubble by the German army. All these people who lived under the Gestapo, they had reason to hate the Germans. We had no particular reason to hate the Germans, not at all. And I remember one of the instructors at the GHQ battle school, he was actually the brother of Stephen Spender, the poet. A terrific worthy, this guy, with the bonnet of the Royal Ulster Rifles on his head at a crazy angle. Rather on the fat side, he was called Barney Spender, and he gave a lecture on hate. It just didn't work. There was a ripple of polite applause, and we all went away just with neutral feelings with regard to the Germans. When we got to Italy and were up against the kind of ragtag and bobtail German soldiers we were, up against. We could feel nothing but a sense of fellow feeling with them. Most of the German army didn't want to be there. They'd rather have been at home. So would we. But by Jove, if you ever heard you were opposite one of the German paratroopers, that was a different story. They were really hard, and they were really good, and they were really keen. I met a guy when I was on leave in Rome. I'd actually met him before in an army course. He belonged to the Royal Scots Fusiliers. And he said to me, I'm recovering from diphtheria in Rome, convalescent. He said, it's a jolly good job I got the disease. Because he said, in my absence, the company of which I was second in command were sitting sunning themselves in their positions opposite the Gothic line one nice afternoon, when without a word of warning, not a shell fired, not a preliminary salad of machine gun bullets, 100 paratroop troops suddenly rushed them and bayoneted the lot to death. They were all killed. So that kind of thing, that kind of really nasty thing, could happen. Well, I'm very glad it never happened to me. I think everybody's got their limit determined by their basic psychology. And my limit was never reached in anything nasty or anything horrible that I had to face or endure actually in combat during the war. No, that little skirmish, for instance, taught me something. The little skirmish brought on by Wilson, the French partisan, and the Fraser getting wounded, etc., and all those bullets being shot around. I discovered in that there is nothing more exhilarating in the world than combat. You behave, as I subsequently read in Xenophon, as if your body belonged to somebody else. You have no fear, no worries. You're on some kind of adrenaline high, and it's just tremendously exciting and wonderful. And the nearest thing to it is rock climbing. And I knew the kind of high, the adrenaline and the exhilaration you can get in rock climbing. I'm very glad to say that my daughter Mary is experiencing that now. You've got the same feeling. And in both cases, it's because you're in imminent danger of death, potentially, rock climbing and in close combat with the foe. And when that happens, you totally and utterly forget about yourself. No fears. You're on a high. You're enjoying an exhilaration, the like of which I have never experienced in any other field of human activity. And I came to understand what the Nazis meant when they taught the Hitler youth that the highest activity in life is battle. I thought that was nonsense when I heard that, first of all, reading it before the war. But by Jove, there was something in it which is stupendously releasing and revealing. You see, life is lived at its most total when it's lived in the present second, the present moving second of time, which in itself is timeless. The present moment is timeless. And if you can live in that, like a poet writing his poems or a craftsman making his chair, and live totally and utterly in the moving present moment of time, you are living life to the full. And in rock climbing and in combat, close combat with the enemy, you are pushed into that present moment of time. You look not backwards, you look not forwards. Your entire psyche, your entire body, your entire everything is crammed into that 1 second, and you're living life to the full. As Scott put it, one crowded hour of glorious life is worth an age without a name. And you could experience that in warfare. And I suppose maybe that's one of the elements that tends to keep warfare going. Pericles was appalled at the youth of Athens, who were so keen to huddle themselves at the Spartans at the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. He said they only do that because they don't know how nasty warfare is. But that was the attitude of myself and my pals in 1939. It was long enough since the First World War. My father had many stories relating to it, but that was ancient history. That was nothing to do with my life. And what was it that Robert E. Lee said after the Battle of God Knows What in the Civil War? He said, it's a good job warfare is so horrible, otherwise people might get to like it. But as I say, I never was put into a position where it was too much for me, where I might, like, say, one of the Lovett scouts, the first time the boys got mortared he went completely mad and ran about barking like a dog. So away he went to the base psychiatric depot, and we never saw him again. Another boy...
Did you see him do that?
No, but I heard about it the same day. It was just a bit further along what was called Woodpile Ridge. Another corporal, I've forgotten his name. We had little first aid packs supplied by the Americans, and they contained morphine serrettes. And this corporal was seen to be unduly balmy and happy, when really he should have been a little bit worried. So it turned out he got hooked on the morphine. So he went away. What? That was his answer to the situation. What?
But you say about the exhilaration of battle, but what about the people who fail in battle, the people who we call cowards?
I don't know that I would think of using the word coward. It's built into you whether you can cope with certain situations or not, and you can't be blamed. It was a development for the better in the British Army. The people who ran away in the face of the enemy didn't get shot in the Second World War. They just got quietly removed. What? No. No, I think the psychologists had taught us enough by that time to know that you cannot overcome basic psychological defects. Can't be done.
Like the chap who started barking like a dog.
Yes, there was absolutely no other reaction, presumably, he could have adopted under these circumstances. But I don't know. And there was the odd, nasty thing happened. I'm always inclined to suppose that of all the armies that have ever trampled over Europe, in comparatively recent times, the most benign has been the British Army. However, odd things happen. It was in the neighbourhood of Paganica, in the Abruzzi, when they pulled us out of the line to practice our skiing in the snows of Gran Sasso d'Italia in the January of 1945. And one of the boys, it seems, got foo on vino. There were signs all over Italy put up by the 8th Army warning you against the terrors of demon vino. He got drunk, and I think he was interested in a girl, and he terrorized the inhabitants of this farm and got them all into a barn and hurled a smoke grenade in amongst them. Now, smoke grenades, of course, are made of phosphorus, and you can get badly burned. Well, by this time, I won't say mastered the Italian language, but as soon as I got to Italy and made my study, the Italian language, reading it and talking it and studying the vocabulary, etc., in every spare moment. As a matter of fact, the last thing that I ever read in this life before I was sent out on the patrol, from which I came back blinded and with the leg off, was the Italian text of St. John's Gospel, Il Vangelo Secondo Giovanni, which I'd picked up in a bombed building, and I was capable of reading Italian pretty fluently by that time. So, when the court-martial was convened regarding this Lovett scout who'd gone berserk on vino and really rather badly injured these Italian peasants in their barn, I was roped in as an interpreter. I was quite pleased with myself because there was an Italian doctor, and no English, giving evidence as regards the burns incurred by the Italian peasants. And he mentioned, I heard the phrase di terzo grado. Aha, I thought I've got you. He's talking about burns of the third degree. Third degree burns. So I was able to manage that kind of interpreter's job reasonably well by that time. But that was a very ugly incident, and that scout was certainly, I don't remember his name or his company, but I'm sure he would do a few years for that one. Whether they would be put into a jail behind the lines in Italy or sent home to somewhere or another, I don't know. And you never bothered. The situation is over, you totally and utterly forgot it. As Charlie Brady said to me, and he had a long history of being in the army during the war, somebody got shot beside you, you just said, "We salute the fallen comrade." Forgot all about him and carried on with the next stage of whatever it was. So, in the end, I was sent out on quite an unnecessary patrol. Monte Grande is the hub of the Apennines, where they've been going north and they suddenly swerve to the west and curl round and then gradually climb up on the north of the Po Valley and become the Alps. And Monte Grande had been a very important, a pivotal point in the recent past in the warfare in Italy with the Americans on one side and the 8th Army on the other. The Americans on the Tyrrhenian side, the 8th Army on the Adriatic side. By the time the scouts were posted there, it was simply because it was necessary to have somebody there, but there wasn't going to be much happening. However, the Jerrys were falling back because this was after their defeat at the Cineo, and they were now heading for the Po as fast as their legs could carry them. And it was important for units of the 8th Army to keep in contact with the retreating enemy. So to that end, a forward locality would be reconnoitred by the scouts where they could move ahead, maybe a mile or two ahead, so as to be closer to the retreating enemy. Well, they sent out a patrol in the morning. I remember watching it. I was on top of Monte Grande in some nice trenches dug by the Americans, and barbed wire and mined areas wired off and stinking dead carcasses of mules and human beings lying around here and there, polluting the air. But I could see with my binoculars Jock McKenzie and a troop leader called Curtis very cautiously reconnoitering away below me. Well, they came back and they simply said to the squadron commander, "No use going down there, the place is just stinking with mines." Well, the company commander would send somebody else down, so that happened to be me. So I put down my Vangelo Secondo Giovanni, got myself ready for the patrol, warned a section of the boys to come with me, picked up a pioneer corporal called Kennedy and another lad to come with me. They were the mines experts, and away down we went. And really, I suppose it might have been the first time I had really seen the wreckage and the chaos and the carnage caused by battle. There were knocked out tanks, rusty tanks down there. The houses such as there were in ruins. The vineyards and olive groves were just all smashed to pieces with shrapnel. The ground was completely churned up and baked hard with the sun. And down we went very, very cautiously. There were a lot of mines that were fairly obvious, so we disarmed these, you know, and deduced from where they were, where other ones might be, dug them up. And then we got to fairly near this casa, this cottage, when Kennedy picked up an obvious shoe mine and was just turning it upside down, which he did, and shook out its contents when it went off and blew his arm off at the elbow. Well, the light was beginning to go. I had to make some kind of a decision. And one of the boys said to me, "That's Kennedy's adjoiner," he said, and that's his right arm. And when I was thinking what to do, I took a step to the left. Mm-hmm. and there was all I experienced was a singing in my ears, dazzling lights inside my head. And when I came to, I was sitting with my rucksack on my back in the little crater which had been made by the shoe mine which I'd just stood on and had gone off. Well, first of all, you feel a sense of chagrin, because you've always believed what every soldier believes, that everybody else can get killed or wounded, but not you. So, having got rid of the feeling of chagrin, I then decided, whatever happened, to stay alive, because I knew of plenty of boys who stood on the shoe mines and died just of shock and dehydration. I gathered my wits together. The first thing I wanted to know, had I lost my foot? So I couldn't use my left hand because it had been smashed by the explosion. And I took my right hand and the leg of the trouser was away. So I felt down there and I got as far as the knee. I thought, well, that's good. I still got my knee anyway. And I felt down further and encountered lacerations. And the foot was still on but twisted at a grotesque angle inwards. No boot on it and no sock. I thought, well, that's good. The whole thing is there at any rate. And I tried to wipe the redness away from my eyes. It was like looking out of a red mask. And then I heard one of the boys, he was called Hoppy Hopkinson. He wasn't a basic Lovett scout. He was what we called an intake who came in to make up for the boys who had been lost from other regiments. Hoppy Hopkinson. He'd actually been an English gypsy in his day. And he said, and his voice was shaking, he said, "Are you all right, sir?" And I remember saying, it was very strange. I said, "Yes, I'm all right, Hoppy, but I think I've lost the sight of both eyes." How did I know that? Because when eventually they got me onto a jeep, the MO, very pleasant English lad, said to me, "Ah, you probably winked your eyes shut just at the moment of the explosion, Scroggy, so you'll probably be all right." But no, the vision has never come back. And the funny thing is, people say what a terrible thing to be blinded and have a leg off in the war and all the rest of it. Not a bit of it. Once you've adapted yourself to the situation, you just carry on living and without any sense of deprivation whatsoever. I have lived as full and as interesting and an adventurous life as anybody who survived the war, and I would not change the life I've had after the war. As I am, blind and with a tin leg, I would not change that with anybody. Interesting.
You said that chap was a gypsy.
Aye. Hoppy Hopkinson.
Did his gypsy background come out in his soldiering whilst you were
with him? I don't know that I knew Hoppy all that well. He was pretty recent importation into the platoon or troop, as we called them. But he had what I might almost call a gypsy face, whatever that is. I've always thought of that kind of face as probably being a Jasper Petulengro countenance. Whether he had the Romany tongue or not, I don't know. So it was a case of field surgical unit here, bumpy jeep roads and bumpy ambulance trips and stretchers, Rimini operations on eyes, leg, plane, Dakota plane down to Bari, Dakota plane to Naples, and finished up in the 92nd British General Hospital, Naples, where I wasn't a sick man. Once they had taken off my leg, which was getting gangrenous, and I stopped being ill, and they took out my left eye, which was getting septic, and got organized. I really had a wonderful time there. It's the time of my life.
Were you satisfied with the treatment that you got?
Oh, couldn't have been better. You see, as soon as you got wounded in the Second World War, you were into a mobile field surgical unit in no time at all. They were very, very close up behind the line, just 10 minutes in a jeep, and you were being patched up. And the extraordinary coincidence is that when I got into that field surgical unit, and Major Murray had done his work on me, and I got chatting with a nursing sister, and turned out she had a brother who'd been at the same school as me in Edinburgh. As coincidences go, I'm still in touch with her to this day. And in fact, these nursing sisters, hard-pressed though they were, working 24 hours a day when the balloon went up, they still had time to, for instance, in my case, she wrote a little note to my mother, my next of kin, a little note which simply said, "Your son has been badly knocked about, but you'll be okay," and wasn't that splendid? She didn't have to do it, but it was in her nature to do it.